we get the program underway this afternoon by getting on the telephone line and welcoming into the program a very talented actor and musician. You know him for his several years as Will Robinson on Lost in Space, from some incredibly memorable Twilight Zone episodes, shows like Babylon 5, the reboot of Lost in Space. Also a very talented musician as well, both as a soloist, as part of Barnes & Barnes, who were on with us to celebrate their newest album, Holidays in Lumania, back at holiday time. But he's got a brand new album with his partners Vicky Peterson and John Cowsill as Action Skulls. The album is called A Different World, and to talk about that and more, we're pleased to be joined this afternoon by Bill Mumy. Bill, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Rich. Well, I hope it's my pleasure.
Well, that remains to be seen, but we'll check in a little bit later and see how it's going here. Love the new album from Action Skulls. You guys have been working together for a few years now. How did you first team up musically with Vicky Peterson and John Cowsill?
Well, thank you. I'm glad you listened to it and dig it. We met actually kind of like an R Gang short. We were at a Christmas party that we had mutual friends at. I'd known John through the Beach Boys for several years, but kind of peripherally. We said hello, but we didn't really know each other well. And of course, we both went back to, you know, the mid-60s when the Cowsills were all happening and Lost in Space was on. John and I used to be in, you know, 16 magazine and stuff. So we would laugh about that. But we were at this Christmas party, and my wife and I, Eileen and I, were going down the block to Angela Cartwright's annual Christmas party. Angela, of course, the actress, my sister in Lost in Space, Penny Robinson back in the day, and Sound of Music, and Danny Thomas. And John was like, wait, you're going to Angela Cartwright's? Yeah, come on with us. Oh, no, we couldn't possibly just go to Angela Cartwright's. I said, yeah, you can. So we walked over with John and Vicky to Angela's annual party, and we sat ourselves down at the, and of course they were welcome, and we sat ourselves down at their piano, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning by the time we decided to leave. Too many eggnogs. No, but, you know, we were sitting around the piano and just, you know, as it is at a party, we started singing Beatles songs and Beach Boys songs, and we were all, the three of us, very, very pleased with this quick blend that our vocals kind of created, you know? And, of course, Vicky being in the Bangles, John having been the Cowsills and a long member of Mike Love's The Beach Boys, and my musical history with America, Barnes and Barnes and stuff, we were all pretty natural harmony singers. And we just liked the blend. And well, said after the party, hey, you know, we should see what would happen if we tried to, you know, sing some original music together. Like, just like a Little Rascals, hey, I've got a barn. It was like, hey, I got a studio. And the next thing you know, we were a band.
Now, what inspired you to create these songs about our current near dystopia?
Well, I wish that hadn't have been an inspiring reality. The album, I believe, A Different World, I'm pretty sure that was the first album written entirely about America's handling of the COVID-19 virus. I started writing that in early March, and the album was put out, you know, in, I think, early May. Came together very, very, very quickly. I had played a gig February 29th with John Sebastian and the reunited Love and Spoonful to 2,500 people, and it was just a wonderful gig. And then 2 days later, or 3 days later, we were all in quarantine. And I thought, well, if that's the last gig I play for a while, that was a good one. And I started thinking about how this pandemic was going to affect different characters. And I wanted to write the story of various characters around America, and how they would, these characters that were in my mind, they weren't necessarily based on specific people, you know, how they would be relating to this shutdown, this lockdown, and this problem. And I wrote 12 songs in like 10 days, which sounds like a lot, but, you know, they They just kind of came out real quick because there was a theme to it. Well, how would this person who can't see his mother think? How would this person who can't leave his house think? You know, how would this person who hates this political choice or whatever? You know, so it was pretty easy, and I I realized right from the beginning that I wanted to keep them all within a framework of kind of classic American folk music, all acoustic, no electric instruments, so that it had a kind of a timeless sense about the music that wouldn't sound dated or that it would just, it could be the Dust Bowl or it could be right now, you know?
Oh, well, and mission accomplished there, because there are elements of folk and pop and blues and jazz all through it. And the title cut, Different World, man, those influences, those connections are so there. Early on, it sounds very much like your friends Dewey and Jerry in America. And then by the end, those beautiful Beach Boys-esque harmonies.
Yeah, John and Vicky sang fantastically on the whole thing. It was interesting. I had started writing and recording these songs. I actually played everything on the record myself because they're in their house and I was in my house, and we have been working on what we would consider kind of to be the second Action Skulls album, the proper second Action Skulls album, for, you know, a year and a half or so. We were pretty close to wrapping that project up when we were quarantined, and, you know, John was off the road for the first time in 20 years for more than a couple of days, because the Beach Boys tour like crazy. And I wrote the first song, Social Distancing Blues, and I just sent it to them, not as an Action Skulls thought, but just to say, hey, what do you guys think? I just popped this one out. And they sent it back to me with their harmonies put on it. And it blew me away, because it's obviously a much fuller and... you know, it's just a better sound when the three of us are singing together than when I'm kind of, you know, singing by myself. And I was so impressed with their harmonies that I said, hey, you guys, now you need to sing on these other 11 songs. And I kind of lassoed them into it, you know, and Vicky was like, oh my God, no, what are you doing? But they did it, and they did a great job. And it fell together very quickly, so it was meant to be.
Well, Social Distancing Blues, that's just the perfect anthem for these times, and some sage advice in there, including your choice of reruns to tune into.
I know. I couldn't resist throwing in that Lost in Space line.
One of my favorites on the album is, I don't believe a single word he says.
Vicky likes that one a lot, too. You know, it's got that cool kind of Pete Seegery banjo line in it.
And that's you on the banjo?
I played everything on the record.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, that's me on my 1962 Vega Pete Seeger model long neck banjo, kind of like the Kingston Trio used to play and Pete played. Yeah, I broke out all the old folk chops that, you know, that's where my musical foundation comes from, is American folk music. And you know, I kind of went on to be a rock and roll guy, but that's how I learned to play, was the folk music catalog. So, yeah, I broke out the banjo, which was a good exercise. Took a couple of takes.
We're talking with Bill Mumy here on Downtown. I also love your solo work. Your most recent album, Lockford, is just terrific. I think my favorite song on there is Take Me Back. Now, did your mom really have the 59 pink Cadillac?
She did.
Oh, man.
My mom had a pink 59 Caddy, and she used to drive me to the studio in that from 59 till about 68, or well, maybe it was more like 66, then she got a Jag. But, and you know what? I was embarrassed by that car. It was very, look at me, you know, and now, right. Of course, I wish I had it. But, yeah, that thing was huge, man. It was huge. I would kind of... With no seat belts or anything, I just kind of curl up in the back seat like it was an office and listen to KFWB and all the early L.A. rock music, you know, Ricky Nelson and the Beach Boys and Jan and Dean and stuff. I can remember that really well.
What's the story behind A Piece of My Soul I'll Never Get Back? It's a very powerful song.
Gee, I had just, I very, very, very rarely paint, you know, but when I do, I have a good time, and I had painted a little canvas, and that's really where the song started. You know, I realized once I was, I said, okay, this is done. Like, you know, you put your name on the canvas and it's done. And I realized, wow, you know, okay, that exists now forever. And I while I was focused on that, that's where my entire essence was, and I'll never get that back now. It's gone. That's kind of what, that was the catalyst for the rest of that song kind of falling together. And then I think it was just kind of, once I'd gotten going, it was a, you know, craftsman thing to complete it. I haven't heard that one in a while.
By the way, your friends Art and Artie Barnes, who were on with us last year, wanted to interrupt the interview to make sure people are aware that Barnes & Barnes' 40th anniversary vinyl of Bouhaha is available. The Holidays, the wonderful holiday album that encompasses every holiday known to man, and Barnes & Barnes t-shirts, all available at DementedPunk.com.
Yes, Demented Punk has really done a great job reissuing Bouhaha and the t-shirts and the artwork and design for the Holidays in Lumania album is very impressive. And it was the first time Barnes & Barnes got back together in over a decade to work on those songs. And boy, it was fun. You know, that's like playing, that's really, truly like playing a character, right?
I mean,
that's like when in Barnes mode, everything is approached from a different mindset than when in kind of, I guess you'd say, normal Moomy mode, if there is such a thing.
Is that an oxymoron?
Yeah. Well, certainly, it's a moron anyway. I represent that remark.
You started, what, 5 years old, you began acting, but you worked with so many giants in the industry. It's like you went to the greatest acting school of all time and learned from the best of the best.
Yes, I completely accept that as a valid truth. I mean, you know, one of the great things about Billy Moomy's career as a child actor, you know, was that there was 6 years of working, you know, 30, 40 weeks a year before Lost in Space. And I loved Lost in Space. I mean, I would go back to, I'm on it now, you know, on the real Dr. Smith on the Netflix series. But I loved Lost in Space, never had a bad day, would go back there in any heartbeat. But the point I was making was I had this great eclectic career working on, you know, Twilight Zone with Rod Serling, or a Hitchcock episode directed by Hitchcock, or then hanging literally in Walt Disney's office while he was telling us to call him Uncle Walt, and swimming with seals, and then doing, you know, like a Have Gun, Will Travel, or I could go, you know, obviously I could just sit here and name a few hundred classic 60s shows and famous Lucille Ball and Jack Benny and Bob Hope and Jimmy Stewart and all. I could go on and on and on, but it was an incredible, as you said, opportunity to learn different styles, different ways to interpret, you know, a script. I mean, working with Cloris Leachman, which I worked with 4 or 5 times, is a lot different from working with Lucille Ball, you know? You certainly can't fault either one of them. Working with Jonathan Harris, oh dear, all the pain, take the boy. You know, working with someone big and over the top like that, a lot different than working with Jimmy Stewart, laid back and real and calm. It was a great experience all those years. I always wanted to do it. You know, I was never pushed or driven or forced to do any of that stuff. So I don't have any horror stories. I mean, you know, a couple bad days here and there, but
no, but you created a few, and I have to talk Twilight Zone anytime. You know, we've had Shelley Fabre on and Earl Holliman, Stephen Talbot, and I have to always ask about Twilight Zone, which is one of my favorite series of all time. And you did 3 of them, but you did 3 of the best in the series history, I think. And I think you can make a case that It's a Good Life is one of the great half hours in the history of television.
Yeah, I mean, it's been called that. TV Guide listed it years ago as one of the top 100 shows of all time, and it sure holds up. You know, it's not like I break out the DVD, but it does run a lot, and somebody will text me and say, hey, you know, Anthony Fremont's on right now or something. You know, I'll go look at it, and man, everyone in that cast was just great. I mean, everyone. The tension is so palpable. The effects so kind of subtle and largely left to your imagination. John Larch, Cloris Leachman, I mean, that's just a great, great show. I'm very happy to have, you know, played that character. And, yeah, I mean, it's great. It really is great. Rod Serling was a terrific, terrific singular talent, you know, and I remember him because, you know, I did the three of them. I remember him as being a very light presence in reality. You know, on camera, he was kind of stolid and focused.
Well, we had his daughter Anne on last year, and she said, "Yeah, that's the side of people, the side of him that people don't know. He was a practical joker. He was funny. He was always having fun with the family, and you know, people saw that, you know, the suit and the tie and the cigarette and the countenance, and thought, well, that's him all the time." But she said, "No, that couldn't be further from the truth."
Yes, absolutely. I know Anne, and I've read her book, and we've talked several times, and yeah, I remember him as, look, there was one of the greatest things about the Twilight Zone. Of course, basically everything about it was great, but it didn't have a regular cast. So the great actors that were on it episode after episode, you know, no one could ever develop a fabulous ego or start acting like, you know, hey, I'm the star of the show kind of a thing. You're there for 5 days or whatever it might be. Rod Serling was the star of that show. And I can remember him being on the set, and everybody from the different departments, the prop department, the wardrobe department, right, the makeup department, the cinematographer, et cetera, everybody being really happy because they wanted to talk to him about the next week's script. They wanted to say, what if we do this? Or hey, what kind of color do you, I mean, not that it was color, but, you know, how do you see this guy dressed? And he was very light. He was a very light presence. And then, of course, he'd do those intros and outros, and he became this great star of the show, this very serious guy. But whether I was 6, 7, or 9, I do remember him very fondly as being a light presence when he was there. Whereas a lot of times an executive producer or a creator, you know, a showrunner, they'll come onto the set, and it causes tension. Right, it causes people to kind of snap to attention and go, oh, the boss is here, you know, kind of a different energy than when Rod Serling was around.
Bill, is it true that CBS came to the folks at Lost in Space fairly early on and said, hey, you've got to lighten this up a little bit. This show is a little bit too dark for what we're aiming for with a family-friendly audience.
Unfortunately, that is true. Irwin Allen's original vision for Lost in Space can be seen in the pilot and in the first maybe 16 or 17 hours of the series. But CBS had placed the series on at 7:30, which was called, and remember, this is 1965. We were at the kind of beginning of that wave of pop culture and everything really changing dramatically so quickly. But in 1965, it was still a pretty conservatively run entertainment industry, although it did change fast. They said, well, you're in the family hour, 7:30, and you're scaring children. We're getting, you know, mail and responses from communities that think the show is too dark, and we want you to lighten it up. So it was a mandate from the network. It was also... really kind of synchronicity-wise, it was also Jonathan Harris, who had joined the series after the pilot had been shot and the series had been picked up. Jonathan joined the series as Dr. Smith, and of course at the beginning of the show he was a saboteur and a real snarling villain, right, who would have happily sacrificed the children's lives in order to benefit his own well-being. And he knew that a character like that dark, wouldn't last very long, that he'd be written out of the show, killed off probably after the first season if he continued to play it that formidably dark. And he started to lighten his character up, to make him more of a fool. I say that with great respect. Make him more of a coward, more of a comedian. And Irwin Allen came to him early on, right around the same time that the network had requested a change in the tone. And Irwin said to Jonathan, "I know what you're doing. Do more." And he gave Jonathan kind of free rein to rewrite his own dialogue, which he did. All the alliterative insults to the robot, you cantankerous clump, you bubble-headed booby, you Neanderthal ninny, all of those Jonathan wrote. And he'd come to the set every day laughing, just cracking up. "Oh, look what I came up with last night." You know, he loved every minute of playing Dr. Smith, that's for sure.
When he became a great friend and mentor to you, and how wonderful that you get to pick up the mantle in this reboot of the series.
Oh, I couldn't be happier about that, you know, and I know it's, look, I try to live in the now. I'm not walking around, you know, saying, "Remember me, I was on Lost in Space," too much. I have stayed close to the creative projects associated with the franchise from the beginning through current times. I wrote the Lost in Space comic book for a few years, and I just have an affinity. You know, I was there from 10 to 14, and those are really formulative years, and I loved the character of Will Robinson because he was like a little superhero, and who wouldn't have liked playing him as a kid? So when they got the script for the pilot to the new Netflix series, gosh, like 4 or 5 years ago now, I read the script. I was, you know, in the in crowd enough to get a copy of the script. And I realized that Parker Posey's character of Dr. Smith, as that we've come to see, she wasn't cast yet, but it was a woman. And we realized in the script, oh, she's not the real Dr. Smith. It's this guy. And I called the producers personally. And I said, "Look, I don't know if you guys want to acknowledge anything from the classic series, but I do know that if Jonathan Harris was alive, he would insist on playing that part. And since he's not, I know he would say, 'Well, if I can't do it, get Billy.'" And I said to them, I said, "I would just love to do that small part." I said, "I think it would be a good ambassadorial kind of, just a nice way to tell the classic audience, the fans of the old show, that I'm wholeheartedly endorsing the new show, and I know that it would just be a hoot, and wouldn't it be great to have Will Robinson be Dr. Smith?" And of course, I ran the risk of them saying, "No, thank you, goodbye." But they were great. They were like, "Oh, would you really do it? Would you?" And I was like, "Yeah." That's why I called. And they have been so wonderful to everyone from the cast of the classic show. This new cast, they've bonded like a real family. And I went up for 2 episodes to Vancouver, and everyone treated everybody just great. And I personally think the show is really good. You know, it's much more aligned with the tone of Irwin's original vision.
Right.
You know, of course, it's expanded and gone into different territory, but that's what, it's not like the Batman movies are all the same or, an homage to Adam West. But I'm very happy to be a part of that project.
Beyond all the terrific things you've done professionally in your career, I look at the fact that you've got a long-term marriage, you have maintained friendships for decades and decades. You seem to be doing it right. Did you get that from your parents? Did you figure it out yourself along the way?
Well, I should be on the couch, I guess, to really think about the answer to that question. My parents, I was an only child. My mom always went with me to the studio unless I was working on a Western on location. Then my dad would go. He was a cattle rancher. I grew up, spent the first 10 years of my life on a cul-de-sac with kids of my within a year or two of my age in every house, in the, you know, late 1950s. And those were the years, the era where, I guess if you were, you know, a middle-class white person in the United States of America, you know, life was great. I literally can remember, you know, walking a mile with my friends to the drugstore with a dollar bill, buying 8 comic books and having a Coke at the counter and walking back,
yeah.
You know, when I was like 7. And, you know, those days are, I used to take the bus to the beach by myself and come back when it got dark, when I was like 12. You know, that's just a different world. My parents never were impressed with show business, and they weren't intimidated by it. They invested the money that I earned for me, so I was never ripped off. And I had the same, here's an interesting thought to that line of thought is, when I started kindergarten in public school, I went to public school until 4 years of being on the 20th Century Fox lot from 10 to 14. But I went to public school from 5 to 10. And when I started going to public school, I was coming and going. You know, the people from the very beginning that I grew up with in my neighborhood were used to me kind of not being there for 2 weeks,
sure,
or 2 months, and then being back. So from the very beginning, it didn't impress, or it's just the way I was to them. And nobody, I don't remember anybody in public school ever acting like I was, you know, some grooveball, like some, you know, celebrity to them. It was just, oh, where were you? I was doing this Disney movie, Sammy the Seal. Oh, okay. Well, you want to play kickball? Yeah. But seriously, I mean that honestly. That was really my reality. It wasn't weird. It really wasn't weird. It was fine. So I didn't get a sense of a lack of friends, and I'm still friends with some of those people. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, I talked to a friend of mine last week for 2 hours that lived a house away from me from the age of when I was 3. I have a lot of friends that I've had since I was a young boy, and I'm grateful for that.
That says something right there. Well, Bill, I've enjoyed your work musically and your acting work for so many years. Great to have you back on in the Bill Mumy persona this afternoon.
Well, thanks, Rich. I appreciate it. For those who are interested in exploring you know, any of my albums or music or writings, Angela Cartwright and I have a fantasy novel that we've written called On Purpose. People can go to BillMumy.com, which is simple, and there's a link to a place called the Mumy Mall where there's a lot of things they can peruse should they choose.
That's awesome. Bill, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, I hope we can do it again sometime.
Yep, well, I'm here. Unfortunately, I'm not,
we're all here.
I'm going anywhere right now.
All right, stay safe, Bill.
You too.